Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, good morning and thank you for joining us today. I'm Michael Fullilove, the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute in Sydney. It's my great pleasure to be here in Beijing and to welcome you to our China Changing Lecture. It's wonderful to see a big crowd here this morning for this very interesting event, and it's particularly nice to see many great and old friends and supporters of the Lowy Institute in the audience. I'm very proud that this represents the first major event that the Lowy Institute has held in China. And I hope it will be the first of many, because we have ambitions to become well known to government officials, to business people, to academics, and to friends in this country. Every time I come here, I am struck by the energy of the country, the ambition, the beauty, the drive of this great country, as well as, of course, the delicious food. And I'm personally very excited to be back. Ladies and gentlemen, the Lowy Institute is Australia's leading think tank. We are independent, non-partisan, and evidence-driven. We look at the world from the perspective of Australia. We are broad. We cover issues from international security to the international economy to the Group of 20, of which Australia is a member, to our own backyard, the Pacific Islands region. We publish our views everywhere from the New York Times to the Wall Street Journal to the Financial Times to Sai Xin. We host everybody from the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, who I hosted last month, to the head of News Corp, Rupert Murdoch, who I'll be hosting next month. But of course, the key focus of the Lowy Institute is Asia. The rise of Asia touches every aspect of the Institute's work, from our research and analysis to our events and our commentary. Everything we do is touched by the rise of Asia. Whether it's our work on the Indo-Pacific region and maritime security, our work on Indonesia, our hosting last year of the former government's Asian Century White Paper launched by Prime Minister Gillard at our headquarters in Sydney. I was delighted 2 months ago that former Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd announced in Jakarta a $10 million fund, a contribution from the Australian government for the Lowy Institute to support our work in engaging Asia. And ladies and gentlemen, there is no country in Asia that is more important than China. And therefore, there is no country that is more essential to the Lowy Institute's work than China. We have a very strong East Asia program at the Lowy Institute under the leadership of Program Director Linda Jacobson, or as you may know her, Lin Lao She. Linda joined the Institute in 2011. Before moving to Sydney, she spent more than 20 years here in Beijing and is one of the world's leading experts on Chinese foreign policy. And we're very glad indeed to have Linda, not as our woman in China, but as our woman on China. Our woman in China, of course, is Ambassador Frances Adamson. This year, the Lowy Institute is celebrating its 10th anniversary. For a number of years, we've held something called the China Changing Lecture. But this year, because it's our 10th anniversary and we believe in birthdays, we decided to host two China Changing Lectures. The first was in Sydney in August and featured a keynote speech from Linda. In her lecture, China's New Proactive Diplomacy, What Does It Mean?, Linda offered her insightful evaluation of the first 6 months of Chinese foreign policy under President Xi Jinping. Other features of Linda's program's work include closed-door workshops in Seoul, Tokyo, and Beijing on security in Northeast Asia. The first will be held at Beidar on Friday. We also recently established the Lowy Institute Rio Tinto Fellowship for Australian and Chinese analysts, and the first China fellow was Zha Daozhong, who joined us in Sydney recently. Ladies and gentlemen, today, this morning in fact, a new government was sworn in Canberra. I was able to watch it over the internet. And I feel sure that one way or another, China will loom large in the new government's foreign policy. And the Lowy Institute will be tracking and analysing the new government's foreign policy and its new China policy every step of the way. Ladies and gentlemen, we've hosted the China Changing Lecture since 2010 with support from the Australia-China Council. Previous lecturers have included Professor Wang Gungwu on US-China relations, Professor Dao Kuei Li on China's changing role in the world economy, and Clinton Dines on 30 years of change in China. And this morning, we're delighted that our China Changing Lecture will be delivered by Andrew Michelmore, Executive Director and CEO of MMG Limited. MMG is majority owned by Min Metals, one of China's largest state-owned enterprises. Andrew is also the chairman of the Minerals Council of Australia board and a director of the Chicago-based Century Aluminium Company. I'm delighted that Andrew will be offering his views this morning on the Australia-China investment relationship and in particular the role played by Chinese SOEs in Australian resource and energy investments. This is an important issue in Australia. China's outbound investment is growing and is likely to continue to grow. But it's not an uncontroversial issue in Australia. It's an issue that is raised frequently in public discussion. It's a controversial issue that raises sticky issues for Australia. Indeed, our Lowy Institute poll, the annual comprehensive poll that we conduct of Australian opinion on a broad range of issues, found this year that 57% of Australians think that Australia is allowing too much Chinese foreign investment in Australia. So I'm very pleased indeed that Andrew will be speaking about this issue today and giving his views. There will be an opportunity for questions at the end of Andrew's lecture, which will be moderated by Linda. The lecture and the Q&A will be simultaneously translated, so you'll be welcome to ask your question either in Mandarin or in English. May I ask you now to turn off your mobile phones? Australians in particular can be bad at this, so please turn off your phones so that we can listen to Andrew. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming this year's China Changing Lecturer, Andrew Michelmore. Andrew.
Her Excellency Frances Adamson, Australian Ambassador to China, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, Da Jia Hao, and welcome. Thank you, Michael, for the warm introduction, and it's certainly an honour to be invited to deliver this year's China Changing Lecture on behalf of the Lowy Institute. It's significant not only as the 10th anniversary lecture, but the first time that it's delivered here in the People's Republic of China capital in Beijing. My talk today, in many ways, builds on last year's China Changing Lecture delivered in Sydney by Professor David Li from Tsinghua University. He spoke about China's readiness to take up global economic leadership. Professor Li's thesis was twofold. First, that China is arguably not prepared for this role, and second, that China will play the role of a global economic leader, but in its own unique way. To me, this is China, a country that dances to its own tune, a people that may not benchmark themselves explicitly against international standards, but look to their own rich history, beliefs, and philosophies as a source of experience and knowledge to find new ways. China will become recognized as a global economic leader because of the scale of its commerce and its investment. Chinese leadership will not be simply an extension of the current ideological framework, but will be defined by its actions and impacts on the world stage. However, today, the topic of my address is very specific. the question of what drives Chinese investment in Australia. And I'm here today speaking from a number of perspectives, as an Australian citizen, as Chair of the Minerals Council of Australia, as a Deputy Chair of the International Council of Mining and Metals, and as CEO of a Hong Kong-listed international mining company, MMG Limited, which is majority owned by one of China's largest state-owned enterprises, China MinMetals Corporation. I will attempt to bring all of these perspectives to bear on today's topic. I'll describe the environment for Chinese investment in Australia, look at the drivers of investment, explore some of the investment models in action, and finally, describe what I see as the potential new era of cooperation between our two countries. The central theme of my address is that effective relationships based on mutual trust are building blocks of success. First, to the landscape of Chinese-Australian investment. In just over 40 years, China has become Australia's largest trading partner, largest source of migrants and international students, third largest tourism market, with Mandarin the second most spoken language in Australia. The relationship is nuanced, deep, and diverse. It is much more than just a northerly trade of commodities in return for a steady flow of manufactured goods to the south. Trade in services is also increasing rapidly, with China now Australia's largest market for services exports. And while Australia's culture has been fundamentally shaped by the last 225 years of European settlement, a recent immigration, cultural and family ties, technology and research partnerships are increasingly Asian. There is one area where this big story of growing cooperation between Australia and China is not yet represented in Australia's economic profile. At the end of 2011, the US and UK combined held around 50% of Australia's total stock of investment. While Chinese direct investment into Australia increased 21% in 2012 to $11 billion, China still represents less than 3% of the total Australian stock of investment. By my calculations, that places them about ninth. And over 90% of the investment in 2012 went into the mining sector, with 56% invested into the resource-rich but sparsely populated state of Western Australia. Despite popular Australian mythology, less than 2.6% of Chinese investment in 2012 went into the agriculture and land areas. While Australia maintained its ranking as the most important ultimate destination for Chinese outward-bound investment since 2006, the total accumulated stock of investment still remains small. It's not for the lack of appetite in both countries for greater Chinese foreign investment. China has a huge reserve in investment funds that cannot all be absorbed internally. Total foreign investment financial outflows are over $70 trillion. China holds significant reserves of currency and financial instruments, but these have been impacted by an appreciating renminbi and an expansionary financial environment through the recent rounds of quantitative easing. It's therefore not surprising that China is attracted to investment in real assets, resources, and businesses to generate returns as an international business owner or foreign direct investor, FDI. As a sparsely populated but resource-rich economy, Australia's story is a very different but complementary one. Australia's economy has been built on net inflows of foreign capital, and this has sustained an economy and standard of living amongst the highest in the developed world. Originally from the UK and Europe, followed by the US and then Japan, Australia has been successful in attracting foreign investment. It has pursued trade liberalisation, progressive economic reforms, and the reform and opening of its financial markets. This investment cycle has sustained Australia through economic cycles over the long term. On the face of it, Chinese foreign direct investment in Australia makes a lot of sense. But when you stand in Chinese shoes, what does Australia look like as an investment destination? When China announced its going out policy in 2000, it relaxed previously restricted controls on outward investments. What China lacked in recent experience, it made up for in access to capital and aggressive valuations and project investment. In developing economies such as the US, Canada, and Australia, China saw stable economies with open and transparent markets, established rule of law, good infrastructure, skills, and attractive, well-managed businesses. Chinese investors also saw high costs, restrictive labor practices, and conflicting and unclear messages on foreign investment. In developing countries, most particularly Africa and South America, China saw less stability, higher political and legal risk, and infrastructure challenges. They also saw great opportunity, policy and project flexibility, and a demonstrable thirst for investment. Australia was an early and willing recipient of investment. Australia was situated in the same region and time zone. The country had experienced 14 years of uninterrupted growth and was already a major resource provider to China. By investing in the development of new supplies in the resources sector, China hoped to hedge against future increases in commodity prices. Australia also offered a depth of management experience, making it an attractive destination to develop knowledge and understanding of operating abroad. The China-Australia partnership looked set to be a reciprocal bonanza. Yet in 2013, the reality of Chinese investment in Australia is still to meet all the expectations set by that compelling rationale. And I believe the reasons rest on both sides of this important relationship. From an Australian perspective, we've embarked on a long cultural and national journey from our European Western origins to a destination embracing a new role in Asia and the Pacific. Some would argue, for example, that Australia still sits in a geopolitical halfway house. On the one hand, seeking to be an Asian nation, but on the other, strengthening security ties and relationships with the United States and its Pacific focus. Last year's seminal white paper on Australia in the Asian century was a timely examination of what Australia could achieve. An Australia that embraced the Asian century would build on its existing strengths and capabilities and would work to deepen our relationship with China at every level. This is the path on which we are embarked, but it is a path along which the whole Australian community has to be encouraged to travel. And in 2013, the Australian community remains cautious about welcoming further Chinese investment, particularly in agricultural land. As Michael mentioned, in a 2013 Lowy Institute poll, 57% of Australian respondents agreed with the statement that Australian government is allowing too much investment from China. This is no different to the early phases of US and Japanese investment in Australia, where community caution transformed to general acceptance over time. The difference in China's case is the challenge of the larger role for SOEs and the foreign investment review process. However, I firmly believe attitudes to Chinese investment will travel a similar path. But Australia must be cautious to send clear messages and retain its competitive position for attracting Chinese foreign direct investment. Most recently, Australia has sent mixed messages and tarnished its reputation for policy stability because of mismanagement and miscommunication around the introduction of the minerals resource rent tax and the carbon pricing mechanism. Following the recent Australian federal election, both these schemes are now again up for review. While the changes should bring certainty and a more rational outcome from the mining sector's perspective, the policy mismanagement has no doubt hurt Australia's comparative investment advantage in resources. Australia is also seen as increasingly expensive. A high dollar and high cost of Australian operating environment, coupled with the lengthy approval and permit regimes, is impacting project returns. Our productivity has been dropping at the time that many developed and developing economies are playing swift catch-up. China also perceives a foreign review process that is unclear and onerous. While in practice, the Foreign Investment Review Board process, also known as FIRB, has proved in most cases to be very workable, again, there is a perception problem. The perception issue relates to ambiguity around review requirements, particularly in relation to what constitutes national interest. Indeed, China Minmetals Corporation's initial bid for all of OZ Minerals' assets is often cited as an example of foreign bid being rejected on the national interest test. FIRB blocked the initial proposal based on the grounds that one of the assets, the prominent Hill Mine, was located in close proximity to an Australian defence facility. In light of this requirement, China Minmetals revised its proposal to exclude the prominent Hill Mine and successfully acquired the assets that formed MMG in 2009. They received 100% ownership approval. It's also useful to understand the role of FIRB in the decision-making process. FIRB's role is an advisory one. It examines proposals for foreign investment into Australia and makes recommendations about whether they are suitable for approval under the government policy. Like any other sovereign nation, the ultimate responsibility for making the decision rests with the executive government, specifically in the Australian case, the Federal Treasurer. There's nothing unusual in this. While assessing hundreds of applications per year, the instances of FIRBs rejecting major foreign investment applications can be counted on the fingers of one hand over the many years that FIRB has operated. Finally, project development, developers and managers in China have also struggled with the practices and institutions that govern doing business in Australia. The different responsibilities for infrastructure provision, the need for proactive management of stakeholder expectations, and the role of the organised labour and engineering and construction contractors have all lengthened project timelines and impacted all costs. Some would argue that China was ill-prepared to be a local operator, and in some cases, that's true. Of course, there have been many successes. What Australian policymakers must be acutely aware of is that capital is mobile and becoming more so with each passing year. Every country must look to its competitive advantages and reduce impediments to maintain competitiveness and grow its share of the global pie. While the stock of total Chinese foreign direct investment in Australia remains comparatively small, models for success are emerging. And in many ways, China has done it the hard way. In preference to minority investment or small-scale and incremental acquisition, China has entered this market seeking ownership, majority, or controlling stakes. This is the dominant Chinese investment model, and it's deeply rooted in established business philosophy. Whether state-owned or private enterprise, the approach has been similar. For a nation of five-year plans that prides itself on robust strategy and successful delivery, the model fits. However, this approach presumes a strong capability in integration and cross-cultural management. And believe me, as a CEO of an international mining company, these are not easy capabilities to develop. It also requires a high degree of due diligence in assessment and understanding of assets and the business risks. This is challenging to achieve in a contested public acquisition. There have been many successes, I stand here before you today as the CEO of a vibrant international mining company with significant Australian and international assets, majority owned by one of China's largest state-owned enterprises. We represent a new and unique model of Chinese investment, and the management of cultural diversity and local participation is at its core. As a chief executive who's worked with many boards and shareholder structures across cultures, I can say at MMG, we are blessed. We share a robust debate on strategy, an international vision for growth, and the support of an investor with a long-term investment horizon. The China Minmetals model is driving a new and more diverse investment approach. Success in acquisitions is being redefined to mean much more than simple ownership control. Generating value is now firmly at the heart of the going out approach. The tenets of strong due diligence, good corporate governance, appropriate risk weighting, and returns on invested capital are now firmly part of the Chinese lexicon. When MMG made its bid for the listed company Equinox Minerals in 2011, it had fairly priced the asset. When Canada's Barrick Gold substantially outbid the offer, we could not see value and we walked away. In 2012, our investment in Anvil Mining was well priced and successful. We now have an operating asset in the highly prospective Congo-Zambian copper belt. These investment decisions were both successful, both preserved and enhanced value, and both were funded, supported, and made possible by Chinese government and policy bank support. This is the emerging China model. I'd now like to spend a few minutes on a question that goes to the core of that model, the role of state-owned enterprises. In 2013 OECD paper on state-owned enterprises, China stood out as a nation with the highest presence of SOEs. China was home to 117 of the Forbes 2000 largest companies, of which 60% were SOEs. When you look at the BRICS economies of Brazil, Russia, India, Indonesia, and South Africa, that same proportion of state-owned enterprises in those economies is estimated at 47%. Indeed, when I was growing up in Australia, SOEs were a large and distinctive part of the Australian landscape in sectors such as airlines, banking, telecommunications, energy, and infrastructure. What is clearly evident is that SOEs play a critical role in nation building. And while the proportion of Chinese economy represented by SOEs is high, the scope and speed of nation building occurring in China is unprecedented. Additionally, the contribution of SOEs to the Chinese economy is in a long-term decline as private business expands. As an international community, it's time to stop judging and start understanding the challenges and opportunities presented by SOEs, and more broadly, sovereign wealth funds, participation in international investment, trade and commerce. That is why MMG is partnering with the Australian National University, the Department of Treasury and Resources, Energy and Tourism in Australia, Peking University and CAS here in China, to look at the transforming role of Chinese enterprise, SOEs and private corporations in global business. Our two nations have everything to gain from adapting and developing this investment relationship. It's already the largest investment relationship China has with any single country, bigger than that with the United States, all of the European countries, or countries in the developing world. So Australia is clearly open for business with Chinese investors, despite the challenges of managing Chinese investment in Australian property. I'd like to conclude with some observations on what I believe could and should define the China-Australian investment relationship over the next 10 years. First, both nations must take an active and partnership role in ensuring that the case for Chinese-Australian investment is made. Both nations must do better to build cultural capability and realise we share a joint obligation to win and build public support for the economic benefits which flow. Second, we must create the policy environment to facilitate growth. A far-sighted free trade agreement between Australia and China would present a critical foundation for continuing partnership. There is much to be gained, and it's time for the protracted talks to lead to real action. Third, we must lower the barriers to investment. Current approval processes in both sides are cumbersome and fragmented, involving multiple agencies at low levels of investment and with unclear expectations. While we must acknowledge that there will be a legitimate level of community concern about foreign investment in any country and in Australia too, there is growing recognition of foreign investment's role in supporting Australia's growth. The Business Council of Australia, of which I'm a member, has called for a rethink about our foreign investment review policies while balancing the need to provide the public with confidence that Australian investments are in the national interest. In an economy-wide action plan released in late July, the BCA called for a higher review threshold for all private foreign investment into Australia and also recommended revisiting the policy for foreign investment by SOEs. It's clear we need more discussion about the role of foreign investment in Australia and how we treat foreign government investment. Fourth, we must remember that government-owned business enterprises are by no means unique to China. China and Chinese companies must clearly explain the evolving role of state-owned enterprises in international investment and acquisition. Misinformation abounds. Indeed, in this area, I feel a deep personal responsibility to better communicate the competitive and commercial reality of China SOEs. The search for stereotypes, and China is saddled with more than its fair share, hides the emerging and complex commercial reality of Australia and China. In both countries, we are in a period of tectonic change. We are facing huge economic and business challenges. I believe that every participant in this important exchange should maintain an open mind to business models, learn how to stand in the shoes of their counterparts, and see the world through different eyes. Through my regular interactions with China Minmetals Corporation, I'm constantly reminded that we face the same business challenges, but we often find solution in different places. There is no one China, there is no one Australia. We are diverse, exciting economies, full of different attitudes, people, and business models. And on that basis, we have every chance of building shared wealth and prosperity. And I'll share with you my own business mantra, as it is relevant to the bilateral relationship as it is to the corporate boardrooms. Relationships are built on trust. Trust builds transparency. Transparency builds solutions, and solutions lead to outcomes. Thank you. Xie xie.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell-Moore. That was, I'm sure, a real treat for all of us who look to you as someone who straddles both the Australian and the Chinese investment world. It's now Q&A time. I open up the floor. I hope you'll all think of a fairly difficult question to ask Mr. Mitchell-Moore. I thought I would lead off, though, and ask you about, of course, SOEs, state-owned enterprises. When I lived here, I was always asked, how is it to deal with the Chinese Communist Party? You have friends, Linda, who are members of the Chinese Communist Party. You work in institutions which are run state-owned educational institutions. How would you say, from an investment perspective, from someone who works in a company owned by a state-owned enterprise, which is at the top run by Communist Party members, What's the biggest challenge in that? Because for us who work here, it's a normal part of life. But often for people who don't understand China so much, it's a mystique.
I probably need to write another paper for that, to do it justice. But I think the interesting thing for me is I came here, SOEs, but I've dealt with different SOEs. And just like there are Australian companies that I would work for, and there are Australian companies I would never work for, same with SOEs. I've had incredibly good experiences with SOEs, and I've had incredibly bad experiences with them. The SOEs that have been out in the international arena and understand that it's different are far more progressive. Those that have grown up inside China and are all powerful in China and believe that's the model they take out into the West and can operate that way end up in disasters. I think the other thing that I see is the competition. Everyone, you read it in the press, in Canada, in the United States, in Australia, China Inc. What I've learned is that there is massive competition between SOEs. They are run by people who want to get on with their careers. Yes, they might be members of the Communist Party, but if they run an SOE, they have the potential to be a vice governor or a vice minister or a governor or even a minister. But they have to earn that. And to earn that, they have to run that enterprise well. And so while they get signed off at SASAC to approve their strategy, they're actually left to deliver it. And if they don't deliver it, as we see, those people disappear. So I think it's that understanding of what happens in practice in the detail. And I see my role is working, it's this relationship. I have to stand in the other shoes. Chi Ching's down the end. We have great discussions about the different cultures and what my actions might be seen as being rude and to people standing in Chi Ching's shoes. What I need to do is explain to Chi Ching that this is my culture, this is the world I live in, how I operate. I'm not trying to be rude. If he can understand that, and then I understand his issues, then we can actually work together. So I think, as a whole, there are SOEs and SOEs. There are some that are strategic. You know, I look at things like in the United States, there are companies that the CIA and NCA have their fingers in and can control. But there's a hell of a lot of other ones that are actually out there just doing business and there's no concern. And I see the same in China. There's a hell of a lot of SOEs that are very good and open in the Western world that no country should have any worry with. It's identifying there's ones with that might have a strategic, sensitive defense security issue and deal with those. So I don't think, that's why I'd say I need to write a paper on this. It's too complex.
I actually think you should do that. Thank you. Okay, so I'll open up the floor now. Please do identify yourselves. And a reminder, the question can be posed in Mandarin. We have interpreters present. So who would like to continue with the Q&A? Please, microphone will be forthcoming.
Andrew, Kevin Hobgood-Brown from Riverstone Advisory. Thank you very much for that very interesting speech. The term cross-cultural came up numerous times in your comments and in your response just now to Linda's question. You've got operations in several countries. You've got the core of your investor base here in China. How do you manage those cross-cultural issues as a practical matter from a management perspective? Those who don't get it right, those examples are pretty clear. It's a disaster. How have you found the most successful management of those issues?
Yeah, it's a good question. When MinMet first bought us, we brought in the Confucius Institute to teach a bit of Mandarin to our employees so they'd have a few words. But then they were also, more importantly, teaching about the culture. When you have a meeting, how you dress, where you sit, how it's set up in a room, you go and have a dinner, how things work.
and I can remember participating in some of those and giving examples of it, particularly with you have to gambai Maltai. And you could see some people in the room hesitating, I can't drink that stuff, and laughing about how, yes, I'd done a few of them, and then one day I picked up a glass of tea and said, yes, I'll gambai this, and people laughed in the room and it relaxed. What we found out of that was learning about the culture and the differences was far more valuable than learning the language. That great quote of, you might speak Mandarin, but that doesn't mean you understand the Chinese. And I think that is absolutely right. It is more important for me to understand Chinese culture and to help explain, you know, you've got to stand in both sets of shoes. You've got to stand in this set of shoes and look at as Chinese culture, how I'm seeing this. And then you have to stand in Western or Australian shoes to understand how you look at it. But you also have to stand in Lao shoes and look at things. And with their Buddhist background, that is quite a different culture. And the sensitivity and the understanding that, unlike Australians, they have respect for older people and seniority. And they find it very difficult to give directions to older people. Or they see something that's unsafe or bad or wrong. They know it's wrong, but they can't tell them. So it's really understanding that culture and then being able to discuss it at work. And this is the key I see at work, is actually having an open conversation where people feel unthreatened by this. And it's not pejorative. You're not saying this is the right culture and that's bad. It's saying they're different cultures. And actually what we've found with it is you see things differently. And this is my mantra. If you can actually do that, you actually see different and better solutions. You actually end up with a better result. So while it's a challenge and it can have negativities if it's not handled the right way, if you embrace it, you actually end up with a better outcome. And I think that's our challenge. There are issues, we now have it where there are issues that are very difficult to deal with. Could be loss of face involved. Three MinMet, three from MMG, we go into a room, shut it, and we actually tell each other what the truth is. And it's amazing, and what the issues are and the pressures and limitations. And then amazingly, we come out with solutions that actually satisfy everything. But it's only because we've had that conversation can you do it. If you don't have that conversation, you can't. But you can only have that conversation if you have trust. And trust takes time. So I think that's why, for me, this is a progress. We're building that relationship. We're gradually building trust. But we have to be honest and not manipulative.
Thank you. Thank you. And some more questions, please. Please, Professor.
Microphone's just coming.
My name is Wang Yong. I'm a professor at Peking University School of International Studies. Thank you very much for your stimulating remarks. Let me echo some very important points in your speech. I also believe a closer economic relationship between two countries serve the interests of the people. And so I think that's very important. I come from the background of international political economy. I think we need to get the politics right.
Yeah.
Okay, I think you're definitely right. And we also have consideration the factor of culture. Okay. There is a very challenging task for the scholars at the universities, frankly speaking. And my question is that, you have a very experienced working with Chinese SOEs and the other sorts of companies. What's your comments on the understanding of Chinese colleagues about the concept of transparency, about the corporate social responsibilities? So I think, do you think that is our, I will be very happy to listen for your comments. Thank you.
I think there's a couple of points there. The transparency is an interesting one. And I think it's experience. It's like when MinMet first bought us and we were putting together our accounts and we were privately owned. We didn't have to come out with media statements or anything, but we did have to file those results with ASIC in Australia. And we made a good profit, and the funding that had bought us was very low cost. And from MinMet's end, it was almost an embarrassment that this had been so successful and the funding was very cheap. And the question was asked was, and we put together the results, and we said that we should put out an announcement on the results. And the question was asked, why would we say anything? You know, we don't want to do this. And we discussed that a bit further, and it was, in China, we wouldn't make any announcement. And as we discussed it, and I remember it was with Ji Qing, and we discussed it and we said, someone is going to look at these numbers and could be mischievous with them and could write something really negative. I said, our approach is we get in first and we write the story about the numbers and we put it out very positively and happy to take any questions. After some discussion, it was agreed, we do that. And it was a successful result. That helped the discussion on the next one about transparency. And we could see that, you know, this issue of actually getting out there and talking about it. And it's not just financial, it can be across a whole pile of things. It's like if we have a fatality, we listed on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange that day. Because we see that's important, it's about our mantra and this is a failure to us. So we don't hide it. And MinMet totally support that. And it's the other side I find really interesting is that I had this preconception from what I read in the media that SOEs, government-owned entities, were bad and private enterprise is much better. That fits the Australian culture. Private enterprise is much better than government-owned. So when an SOE bought us, I was thinking, ooh, this is going to be interesting. And the interesting thing about it, when we had a failure in a pipeline in Queensland and some about 10,000 tonnes of zinc concentrate came out of the pipeline, and we immediately stopped the pipeline, cordoned off the area, talked to the local landowners, put a barrier around it, started cleaning it up, started working on the pipeline. The interesting thing, it was unbelievable. MinMet rang and asked, could they do anything to help? Did they need to come down to Australia and talk to the government? They were very concerned that they would be seen as, this is what happens when a Chinese company owns you. And I'm saying, no, this is local. We've been operating for 10 years here. We will deal with this and we'll deal it that this is a maintenance issue on this pipeline. We had some hiccups in terms of fixing up the pipeline. It took much longer. And the interesting part, again, was MinMet's questions were about how is the cleanup going? Is the government satisfied with what your plans are? Are the local landowners satisfied with how it's going? And they were all questions around environment, safety, fix-up, reputation, community relations. They never asked me how much did it cost or how soon before you get production. If I put on my previous hat when I was in WMC, I would have had the media, the shareholders on me every day wanting to know how soon would production be back and how much was it going to cost. And for me, this was the difference between being owned by a really good SOE because, and then it hit me, why? Because it's their reputation. MinMet doesn't want to have a bad reputation. China doesn't want to have a bad reputation in Australia for these sorts of events. And so it then turned around to me that actually if this was a privately owned Chinese company, they probably would have been asking me how much is it costing and when are we back in production. So it was I had to sort of change my whole mind and thinking around, wow, this is actually really positive. This company, these owners are actually looking for the long term, and they're actually concerned about the relationships over that long term. Wow, that's what we need. So I think there's some really interesting learnings that we can have through this. Now, I don't say every company is this. I say MinMed is really good. But, you know, I think they're the examples that need to be talked about and demonstrated. Whereas I know, you know, in Africa, in parts I go into, there are some horrific stories of Chinese companies. This is China. But when you look at it, they're small, medium-sized private companies who've done some terrible things, but so have Australian companies. So it's not just, you know, it's not just China, but it gets written that way in the media, and that's the perception that comes out, and that's what we've got to change. And I think where China can be seen, the government, the agencies, whatever, can be seen to be saying, this is unacceptable, I think that helps all of us. Sorry, long answer to a short question.
Thank you. We still have time for, let's say, two questions. Now I see about six hands going up. A lady is right here. That's nice always to see a lady. And then I think I'm going to take the last question.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Gao from Peking University. Thank you very much for your very interesting presentation. I have many questions, but here I bring only very short question. Chinese investment has successfully flowed to Australia mining energy sector, energy mining sector, basically during past 6 years, particularly after 2008 global financial crisis. However, the new government after 2013 election, they Conservative Party coalition is organizing new government. So from your personal opinion, how do you think what new policies towards China, particularly towards Chinese investment to Australia mining energy sector will be introduced by new Australia government? How will new Australia government balance the strategic security relationship with the U.S., simultaneously the strategic trade partnership with China? Thank you.
So this was the most challenging question of all. What's the new Conservative government going to do in its relationship with China? How's the investment relationship going to proceed? And then mix of security there too. So please.
I think I'll leave the last one to really last. It's really difficult. And I don't speak for the government, but I can, wearing my Business Council of Australia hat, I know we've had, and I sit on the foreign investment section, and we've written papers and made it very clear that Australia survives and will only grow on foreign direct investment. I'd say the coalition absolutely understands that. They need it. It's the terms and conditions around it, really, that's the issue. It's like, you know, they should be using us as a success. Yes, we have certain terms and conditions. But it's also making it clear from the overseas, whether it's Chinese, US, wherever, who want to invest, they need to understand that there's a standard policy, that it's very clear, it's simple, and it's encouraging. Because I think the biggest issue we've seen is all the uncertainties generated by the past 6 years of government has thrown out the window that what for me is a AAA rating for Australia in terms of being secure, being reliable, you know, being the best way, the example of how to do it. And I think the new government, and we're certainly feeding them that message, they need to get back to being simple, straightforward, supportive, reliable. So I think we will see that. I also make comments that in the lead up to an election, lots of things are said and lots of promises are made, and people go chasing a vote here or a vote there, and they'll say things that are totally different, trying to get both votes. I think once you get the government in and we have the ministers in place and their advisors, we can sit down, BCA, MCA, we will work through what the policy should be. And I'm feeling quite positive about that. In terms of defence, there's a lot of debate in Australia. There's a lot of history that goes with concerns about nearby nations and who would support Australia. And Australia's got a lot of land, not many people. Nearby nations, small amount of land, lots of people. What is the concern? And they're supported by Russia, the availability of weapons. You see this around the world. They're sold. I don't care who they sell them to. And they'll sell them the latest technology weapons, or probably latest technology minus one. Australia, therefore, has to keep up to, and so that they feel comfortable, at the latest technology minus one at least, and what they've been doing is falling behind. So I think Australia's in a difficult situation that they have to look at, where do we get that support from? On the other hand, they see the relationship with China, and I think Australia, if I'm reading between the lines, they actually want a good security relationship with US and a good security relationship with China. And the challenge is, how do you do both? That's where the difficult part really comes, because you've got a three-way arrangement. But I think that's the challenge. And again, I think the populace, the public, will express their views on that. They want strong non-military type relationships and not feeling that we're putting all our bets in one spot. But a very difficult... You probably should talk to ambassador representatives to be able to get a proper official line on this.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell Moore. We're already over time, so I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to take any further questions. Personally, I'd like to say thank you. This has been a long road together. I'm now going to invite Dr. Fulilog back to give some concluding remarks and ask you to stay here.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you'll agree that we've been very fortunate indeed to have Andrew Michelmore speak to us today so openly and so frankly, and to get the thoughts from somebody who does, as Linda said, really straddle our two countries. And I was thinking, particularly when Andrew was talking about some of the challenges of operating between the two countries, that there are always things that divide two countries, but perhaps the things that unite China and Australia are greater and more profound and more long-lasting than the things that divide us. So thank you, Andrew. I'm delighted that we've been able to bring the Lowy Institute to Beijing, as it were, for this lecture. I was also struck by Andrew's comment that Australia is on a journey with its engagement with Asia in general and its engagement with China. And certainly from our point of view, we hope and intend that the Lowy Institute will play a role in helping to light the way for Australia on that journey. Let me thank the Australia-China Council for its support for this event, and in particular to our Ambassador Frances Adamson for her encouragement and support. Thank you, Frances. Thank you to my colleagues, Lin Lao Shi, Dirk van der Klauw, I don't know your name in Chinese, Dirk, and Kate Weston for all of their hard work for this lecture. Ladies and gentlemen, there'll be a buffet lunch served now next door. Let's continue the discussion informally over some food. Thank you very much. Xixi Da Zha, thank you, everybody. Thank you, Andrew.